Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Robert Borquez, registration number 19577, representing MLB, the appellant in this matter. And Your Honors, what this case presents is a question of whether a man with a lengthy history of severe mental illness was competent to waive his right to counsel and to represent himself in a serious criminal case where he was facing a potential of 90 years in prison and where he actually received a sentence of 60 years. As the record indicates in this case, MLB suffered from this lengthy history of mental illness, and it started back in the early 90s when he was in his early to mid-20s. And the history is set forth in our opening brief, and I believe the people even went into a large part of this history in their answer brief. And the record is quite lengthy documenting my client's condition. So I'm not going to spend any more time on the facts in the case since I have all read the briefs. I do want to talk primarily about the first issue we raised in our brief, because I'm not sure you get to the second issue, the Hendricks hearing issue, unless you find in our favor on the first issue, which has to do with his competency to counsel. Because if you don't find in our favor on the first issue, there's nobody that would have been in a position to have standing to make the claim under the Hendricks case that counsel should have been able to introduce a not guilty by reason of insanity plea.
Mr. Borquez, I'm sorry for interrupting you early, but I'd like to ask a question about the proper standard of review here. Defendant here wanted to proceed as his own lawyer and said so after a clear advisement from the court. Thus, how are we supposed to review this? It's not like he objected and preserved the error. He said, this is what I wish to do. So, is this a plain error analysis? Is this an invited error case? What are we supposed to do?
I don't think it's an invited error case, Your Honor. I think that the issue was raised when the trial judge conducted the Arguello advisement. Right? In other words, the court brought the issue up by conducting that advisement. Now, granted, the record is clear that he did say he wanted to proceed pro se, but it's our position that he was not fit to make that decision.
But how are we supposed to review it? It is, for example, in Davis, in that case, the court imposed counsel on the defendant over the defendant's objection. So that alleged error was preserved. Here, this is something the defendant wanted to do. So what is our standard of review? How should we look at this error in order to analyze it?
Well, in the worst case scenario, this would be subject to plain error, but I think that there's enough there that this court can look at it. Granted, there wasn't an objection raised. I'm not claiming that there was, but I think even under a plain error review, Your Honors, you've got a substantial right that's involved here, and you've got something that is plain obvious in the record, and that's his condition. I think that this case went on for 3 years between 2005 and 2008 before there was that what I call the final Arguello advisement, just before the March trial. I think it was February 27, 2008, where they went through this for the last time, and he wanted to go pro se. But I think that there's a lot there that were red flags for the court as far as his condition and whether he was competent to go forward. So even if the record is not clearly preserved, I think it would be subject to plain error review. And there's ample material in the record to allow for that in this case.
So let's assume we proceed on that theory. Your contention is that the trial court clearly abused its discretion in finding he was competent to proceed, correct?
Yes.
Now, it's a factual finding that the trial court has to make. It's not something that we can do on our own, correct?
I think that the trial court applied the wrong standard, Your Honor, because I think the trial court, and in fairness to the trial court didn't have the benefit of the Indiana versus Edwards case when it was making these decisions. Right? So the trial court was limited to what was before it, but the Edwards case came down while this case was still pending, and the judge judgment had not yet become final.
Well, that doesn't answer my question, though, because my question relates to, is this a factual determination that the trial court is entitled to make, to which we have to accord deference, or is it something we can do on our own without regard to what the trial judge said?
The trial court made certain factual findings, but I don't think the trial court applied the right standard in making those findings. And what I'm focusing on was, I think the court gave too much weight to my client's ability to make decisions for himself.
Is our review limited to the hearings, or at least two hearings, one very shortly before the trial, or does our review extend into the trial itself?
I think you can look at the entire record, Your Honor, and I think that shows that the way he conducted himself reflects in the trial record how he was able to represent himself. And I'm not talking about legal skill, because the case law is really clear about that. It's the question of competency has nothing to do with a pro se litigant's legal skills. It's whether they're able to perform the functions that a defendant operating pro se would be expected to perform in the courtroom. At one point during, I think it was the first trial, when he heard the victim testify, he was so shocked that she didn't testify in his favor that he pretty much lost it. He couldn't go forward. The trial judge had to recess the proceedings. They came back the next day, and the trial judge had a mistrial case. I think the court can look at the entire record here.
And this is not the first time he was charged with harassing this same victim.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I mean, the habitual criminal charges arose out of previous convictions.
That's correct.
And yet, in the first trial in this case, he was surprised she would testify against him?
That's part of my argument, Your Honor. That's part of the irrationality of the way he was making decisions. That he had this woman that he became fixated on, that she asked him in the 1990s to stop calling, stop writing. He continued. There was the 1998 case that was brought against him. And he saw what she had to say at that proceeding. It was the 2001 case, and he saw what she had to say there. And lo and behold, we're in this case, 2005, and he's surprised that she's still testifying against him. I mean, that's part of our argument, that there's a lack of rationality in his decision-making.
Well, Mr. Borges, you talk about the Davis test, which is how would he do as a pro se defendant at trial? And according to my review of the record, he discusses motions with the court, including a joinder motion shortly before trial. He engages in voir dire with the jury. I agree that he says some strange things in the course of that, but he talks with jurors. He examines witnesses. He cross-examines witnesses. He provides closing argument. And understanding, of course, that he has a history of mental illness, and again, he said some strange things, why don't those things satisfy Davis?
Because, Your Honor, I think that there's more that's required under Davis. I think that, again, it doesn't have to do with his legal skills, but I think that he has to be grounded in reality. And some of what he did, I mean, the questioning of witnesses, and in particular, the victim, about these conspiracies, the government conspiracy and the Hollywood conspiracy. Even at one point, at least one of the jurors sent a note out to the trial judge questioning what was going on here. Another juror, or potential juror during voir dire, was concerned that he was making a mockery of the proceedings. I mean, the people on the jury saw what was going on. And it's troubling that the judge, the trial judge, and the district attorney were just pretending like nothing was wrong here. At one point, when he was going to testify, in order so that the voices wouldn't, or the noises wouldn't bother him, as he kept complaining about noises, they let him testify wearing a headset with earplugs in. I mean, granted, he knew what voir dire was. He knew what an opening statement was. He knew when witnesses would be testifying. My client is a very intelligent man, but he's also a very sick person. I don't know if that addressed your question.
It did address my question. Thank you.
I've got about 5 minutes left, and I'm wondering if there are any more questions.
If we were to agree under Edwards that the trial court had discretion to deny him his right to represent himself, have you formulated in your own mind a standard by which that might be determined?
All right, that's a good question, and I saw that 2 days ago the State Supreme Court granted cert in a couple of cases.
Excuse me, raising the same issue.
Yeah, and I think that eventually they're going to decide this one way or another, and I know that doesn't help this panel because you have to basically read their tea leaves and see, predict the future, and that's not easy, but I think there's language in the Edwards case that talks about that. You know, competency being whether he's able to carry out the basic tasks needed to present his defense without counsel. And I know that gets back to the question, does he know what side of the courtroom to sit in? Does he know what a jury is, what a judge is, what the functions are? But I think there's something more than that. I think there's got to be at least some kind of recognition of what's going on, and it's got to be reality-based, and that wasn't what was going on here. He was convinced that he was basically a pawn that's in this game that's supposed to bring this case eventually to the U.S. Supreme Court and challenge Colorado stalking laws on First Amendment grounds. And that's not a rational defense in this case. His advisory counsel made really clear that he really only had one defense that was available, and he was walking away from that.
Counsel, the fact that that might not be a successful defense doesn't mean that it's not rational, does it?
I think that in this case, Your Honor, it is so based on his illness, that it is so grounded in that he is getting these messages he's supposed to do this. I think...
If I may interrupt, and I apologize, but there have been First Amendment issues raised about the stalking statute, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
And by other people.
By other people, but they aren't getting messages that are telling them to do this. And I think that there's a lot of established case law as to the constitutionality of the stalking statute. And I think that a person grounded in reality is going to be able to read that and say, well, this is probably not going to get me anywhere, this defense. So I think you've got to look at what was driving his decision making. One thing I wanted to clear up as far as what we're asking for by way of relief in this case. And my client isn't entitled automatically to a new trial in which he can raise an NGRI plea. I think that what's got to happen here is we're asking you to remand this case to the trial court to apply the standards that were set out in the Edwards case and that were addressed in the Davis case, and to determine whether he was competent to go forward based on those cases. So if there are no other questions, it looks like I have a minute and 52 seconds, so I'd reserve that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Matthew Holman, and I represent the people in this matter. I wanted to start with the plain error question, which this court addressed initially. I do think that this case is subject to a plain error standard. I think at the time that the defendant initially decided that he wanted to represent himself, there wasn't any question about whether he was competent to do so. In fact, his attorney also thought so, that he was competent to proceed pro se. So there was no objection. And no
competent to proceed pro se?
Yes.
Or competent to assist in his defense?
Well, I think at that time, his counsel admitted or stated that he was competent to represent himself. I think it was at the initial time. I know also later on when he had gone back and forth.
Now, this is the same counsel that was trying to get the not guilty by reason of insanity plea imposed, and said that this was the only viable defense he had to a case which, from my experience, is fairly easy to prove.
Well, I think actually she said this was his best defense. I think she said, she also stated at one point that he had good questions prepared. This is again later before the actual final trial. She said he had prepared good questions. that defenses he had raised, such as weakness in evidence, whether there was a credible threat under the law because he was incarcerated at the time, that all of these were good legal defenses for him to raise. I think it was her opinion that he should also be pursuing the insanity defense, and that she thought that was maybe the stronger of those choices. So I don't think it was the only defense. I'd like to just return to the plain error question, because I think this is a case that, you know, the plain error standard is interesting, because I think normally we think of it in the context which exists here, which is someone doesn't alert the trial court to an issue that needs to be addressed, that when plain error applies. But I also think it applies in a situation like this, where the case we're now looking at, that we are saying should have been applied, didn't come out till years after the trial in this case, and that somehow the trial court should have foreseen that this essential addition or mutation in the law. And I think that the plain error standard requires, among other things, that the error be obvious and substantial, and it seems impossible that this could be obvious, that the court wouldn't apply a legal standard that had not been articulated by the Supreme Court. And actually, up until that time, the U.S. Supreme Court had consistently applied the Dusky standard, both in Dusky and the case which is Godinez versus Moran. So I think, one, that plain error applies here, and two, that the defendant can't overcome the initial hurdle of the plain error standard, which is that the error needs to be obvious. I do think, in answer to Judge Casewell's earlier question,
does it have to be obvious factually or obviously legally?
I would say it has to be obvious both factually and legally, and I think the facts here demonstrate that it was not factually obvious that the defendant would not be competent to represent himself at trial. I think all of the evidence here showed that he was, again, he suffers from a mental illness, but is extremely intelligent. There's a point in the record where he's asking the court to clarify whether the court's asking him about a Hendershot issue, a Hendricks issue, which is about whether he should be allowed to go forward without an insanity defense, or whether the court is asking him about whether he should be allowed to proceed pro se. And the court says they're intermingled, but the court recognizes that he has seen a distinction in the law, and I think throughout the proceedings, it's clear that he has a very good grasp of the law. He talks about...
Well, these people with paranoid schizophrenia are not constantly appearing mentally ill, are they? I mean, they go in and out of these states when they're during the normal course of their life. They can be completely cogent. And I would agree with you, in the hearing before the trial, during the Arguello advisement, and during all the discussion that preceded that, I would, if you told me he was an attorney, I would have believed you.
Yes,
the transcripts are clear, the discussion is clear, the answers are unequivocal. But then you look at the dialogue that occurs right after voir dire, when he's talking about all these messages he gets from television commercials and other sources about that he has to go to trial, that he's innocent, and his continuing illusion that this victim's going to testify for him. It's obvious that he moves in and out of these states, and the fact that he was profoundly with it in the hearing before the trial doesn't necessarily mean, with the long-standing diagnosis and the trial court's own experience with him in the first trial, where they had to declare a mistrial because he thought the victim was going to testify for him. It seems to me the record is replete with evidence. Well, this person is not living in a real world.
Well, one is absolutely, over time, there are points where his competency is questioned, his medications are adjusted at various times, and then there are times where the doctors have determined that he is competent to proceed. So I agree, over the long period of time, there are those changes in his mental state, and the court and defense counsel and even the prosecution, I think I would say, are being very cautious in allowing the time for him to exercise his rights when he is able to do so. I think the other thing, though, that you brought to my mind is the trial judge is the one who was there observing all of this behavior, and granted, his argument seemed bizarre and unusual. On the other hand, he is putting forward what he truly believes is his perception of the events that occurred here, his motivations for those letters and contacts with this victim, his perception of what he thinks her view of that's going to be, and albeit it's based in his own odd or bizarre perspectives, but I think he's doing what he's entitled to do, which is put on the case as he sees fit. I don't think anyone's saying that he was disingenuous in these arguments or he was not sincere in putting forth the facts as he saw them to be put forth. It may be that it didn't turn out to be a winning position for him, but he is certainly entitled to present his defense, what I would call an open and honest defense of his perspective on the case.
Mr. Holman, isn't the discussion you've just had with Judge Roy the exact reason that we say we give deference to the trial court's determination of competency as opposed to trying to do it ourselves?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And this clearly is a case where the court, and again, is very receptive to the situations where if he appears incompetent, as far as whether his counsel or sometimes his advisory counsel or the prosecution or the defendant sees it, is alert to that and is reacting. So the court is in the best position to assess those situations. That's correct. That's a little roundabout answer to your question, but yes, that's correct. I think the other thing, which is pointed out in the Wilson case, as a legal principle is significant here, which is in Wilson, the court stated that Indiana versus Edwards doesn't require that we apply a heightened standard before a defendant's able to waive counsel. Rather, it provides a state with the opportunity to apply a test when you're going to compel representation by counsel in a case. So I think this case is like Davis in the sense that what we're not talking about, are we going to force counsel on the defendant here, in which case we might have the Davis situation and need to apply an Indiana versus Edwards type of test. What we have here is a question of, did the court rightfully find, what I would say under Dusky, that the defendant was competent to proceed? And I think that's what the court did here. So I think even if we reach past several procedural hurdles here, I think what the court did is supported by the law also.
Pardon me, Mr. Holman. The trial court had comparatively shortly before this trial found defendant competent to proceed, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
In your view, does that satisfy Wilson?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. I think it complies with the Dusky requirement that he's competent to proceed, and that would be sufficient under Wilson. I think Wilson it points out that really we get to the Indiana versus Edwards situation in a case like Davis, where the defendant has been had counsel foist upon him over his objection, in essence, and then the question becomes whether that's an appropriate thing and how do we assess that in keeping with the United States Constitution. I think what Indiana versus Edwards says is you can do that. You know, Indiana versus Edwards, they are reluctant to set forth a specific test, but they essentially say that that's appropriate if it's found that he's not competent to proceed.
Well, they rejected Indiana's test because they didn't think that it couldn't anticipate its ramifications, as I understand it.
You're correct, Your Honor. I think Indiana offered a suggestion that if the defendant was not able to coherently communicate with the jury and the court, that would be the test. And they essentially said, we're not prepared to pick that as a specific test because we can't foresee how that will play out. And you know, as a side note, this is very common of cases that come out of the U.S. Supreme Court or any appellate court, which is it will set forth general guidelines, and then it's for the trial courts to start figuring out in specific circumstances how you apply that test and fine-tune it, for lack of a better term.
Perhaps they think we're better equipped to do it.
I'm sure that is exactly right, Your Honor. And I would agree, just for the record. So so I think that clearly The defendant here has some serious mental problems, and he has some apparent delusions about his motivations for what's going on. I guess I want to talk briefly about the strength of the insanity defense, and we didn't talk about the not guilty by reason of insanity, but I want to talk about it in this context, which is the evidence supporting the insanity defense was unusually weak. There was only one expert who testified that she thought that he met the qualification for insanity, and that was Dr. Fukutaki. But the problem with her test is there, I guess I should back up. There are two forms of insanity defenses. One is that you're unable to form the culpable mental state for a crime. That did not apply here. Everyone agreed to that. But there's another one, which is you're unable to tell right from wrong. And this is the one that Dr. Fukutaki looked at. However, she testified that he was able to know that what he was doing was illegal, that it was wrong, but that his motivations were based in his delusions. And that doesn't fit squarely into our insanity defense. And that's, the trial court at one point finds that, that he finds that Dr. Hoffman, who essentially says, yes, he can tell right from wrong, and so he's not insane, found that one to be a more persuasive opinion. So I don't think there's strong evidence of insanity here, and I think in the defendant making this decision about which defenses he wants to take, that would automatically, that would necessarily get weighed into the situation.
Well, it's certainly true that profound mental illness does not necessarily rise to insanity.
That's absolutely true, and the defendant had looked at what's called the Hendershot defense, which he talked about. And I would say in some way he almost put on a Hendershot defense, which is that he displayed what his mental perceptions were about the situation and his motivations for his behavior. And again, I would say there's no, it's never been claimed there that he was disingenuous in his sincerity about his feelings for the victim here or his motivations for doing these things. And again, it ultimately the jury heard the evidence and determined that he had broken these laws, but he put on what I would call an open and honest defense.
Well, pardon me, counsel, but indeed at one point, didn't he, during closing argument, over the court's interruption, impose Hendershot-type argument to the jury?
That may be correct, Your Honor. I honestly don't recollect at this time, but that would sound correct to me. And again, he's obviously very intelligent. I think if you look under all, we have a series of sort of tests to protect him, the Arguello test, the Dusky test, and perhaps an Indiana versus Edwards. And to go back to a question Judge Bernard asked of Mr. Borquez, I think he would meet, satisfy the Indiana versus Edwards test. One is I don't think he's a gray area defendant, as the law calls it. He's clearly competent to represent himself, and as Judge Roy said, as well as many attorneys, actually. I mean, in the context of his own perceptions about his motivations, his understanding of the law is very impressive, and his ability to question witnesses, conduct his voir dire, as unusual as it was showed that he was perfectly competent to do this.
Well, there was a Nobel Prize winning mathematician, whose life was depicted in the movie The Beautiful Mind, who was certifiably crazy.
I see I'm out of time. If there are no more questions, I would thank the court for this.
Thank you.
Please, the court, in my 1 minute and 52 seconds, I've got 2 points I just wanted to bring up. To address a question that Judge Roy raised about under plain error, whether it has to be legally or factually obvious, and counsel said both. I would submit that as far as legally obvious, there is language in Arguello from 1989 that talks about the vaguely higher standard that incorporates the language from McDonnell. I realize that Godinez then talked about Dusky being the standard for competency to discharge counsel, but it's our position that Godinez applies in cases where a defendant fires an attorney and enters a guilty plea, and that where a defendant fires an attorney and wants to proceed to trial, it should be a different standard. And I think whether it was factually obvious, I think the record is replete with evidence to support that. The other point I wanted to cover just briefly is that the trial court actually did just before the March trial at the February 27, 2008 hearing status conference. Note that there was at least a scintilla of evidence that would support a not guilty by reason of insanity plea. Where the court rejected that was really on the other prong of the test under Hendricks. So those are the only two points I wanted to cover if there are no other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both gentlemen for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.